call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. We are going to reverse the order on our agenda today, and we're going to start out with a public hearing on Senate Bill 878. Chris.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 878 creates the Oregon New Markets Development Program, which is modeled after the federal New Markets Tax Credit Program. The bill creates income and excise tax credit for quality equity investments in businesses located in low-income communities. The credit equals 39% of the qualified equity investment taken over 7 years. There is no credit allowed in the first 2 years after the initial investment. Then there's a 7% credit in the third year, and then in the remaining years it's an 8% credit. It's a non-refundable credit and may be carried forward to any succeeding tax year. The bill specifies conditions that must be met for the taxpayer to be eligible for the credit and limits the amount of qualified investments in a qualified business to $10 million. So that's kind of a project basis for the source of these funds. And the bill also requires the taxpayer to apply to the Department of Revenue for certification. And the bill currently contains a blank, but it limits the total amount of tax credits that the department may certify for any given tax year. The bill also specifies conditions upon which the Department of Revenue may recapture tax credits.
Okay. We're going to start out with a panel with Craig Campbell, Ryan Brennan, and Carl Talton. And it looks like Jack Isselman might be part of that panel. Pull up another chair. Unless
they're break the furniture.
Oh, no. It's tearing up the furniture. Get security.
It'll be the first time.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell, and I'm here on behalf of Advantage Capital Partners on Senate Bill 878 in support. It's not very often, especially this session, when you have an opportunity to come with kind of a good news proposal for our difficult economic times. What Senate Bill 878 is designed to do, it's to provide a sweetener for investments that are being made under a federal tax program, the New Markets Tax Credit, which other members of the panel will talk about in more specificity. But what this does is that it gives Oregon an advantage by creating a matching tax credit, because the federal money can go to any state based upon where the investors want to invest that money. Right now, the only other states that have instituted this kind of a program are along the Mississippi and further east. So there has been no development in the West Coast and our area, which makes Oregon, if they were to pass this particular tax credit program, it would allow us to have a strategic advantage in developing new businesses in the state of Oregon. You're used to hearing the term tax credits in a rather negative way. This one is a little different. What this tax credit essentially is, it's an investment in businesses in Oregon where you will see the return on the investment before the state actually ever puts out any money. This program would take place over a 7-year period of time, but the tax credits for those who are making the loans to those companies that are expanding or developing, that comes in for them in years 3 through 7. During the first 2 years, they're investing money, those businesses are operating, they're providing jobs, those jobs are creating income taxes, and the state is getting a return on their investment. The individual to my right, Ryan Brennan, will talk a little bit about the experience that we've had in other states. But if you notice, you have a map in beautiful lavender. This is a map that was determined by the United States Treasury as a result of the last census, and it identifies those areas that constitute low-income areas of the state. This tax credit requires that investments be made within those areas, and you'll note that there's a substantial rural element, but there are also significant areas in Portland, Eugene, Salem, and most of our other larger communities. So the investments are going to be statewide to create jobs in areas that desperately need them, and I think it doesn't take us too much to figure out that by the time the next census comes around, unfortunately in Oregon there will be a heck of a lot more fuchsia on that map than there is currently, considering that this was done in the 2000 census. I think with that, I'm going to pass it over to Carl. Do you want to go next and talk about
sure,
the federal program?
Sure, happy to.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Carl Talton. I'm the executive chair of Portland Family of Funds. Portland Family of Funds and its affiliate, United Fund Advisors, are Oregon-based companies that provide financial services and develop and employ triple bottom line investment strategies in communities across the country. I really do appreciate the opportunity to share a little bit about our program this afternoon and to hopefully provide a little bit of insight in terms of the legislation before you. Let me give you a little bit of background on the federal New Market Tax Credit Program. It was enacted in 2000 to spur economic development and job creation in low-income communities by attracting private capital. The program is administered by the Community Development Financial Institution Fund of the U.S. Treasury. So far, $26 billion in total allocation authority in that program. To date, it's provided 364 awards to 218 CDEs. These CDEs are community development entities. This will be language that if you're not already familiar with, you'll become familiar with. A community development entity is simply an entity that provides investments in serving low-income communities and persons. There's an additional $1.5 billion for this next round, which is round six, which will be provided in the stimulus package, and also a $5 billion in round seven, 2009. That may be the final round. So far, they've seen fit to extend the program 1 year. That's the current year that we're in. The Market Tax Credit Program has an enviable track record across the country. It's done an exceptional job of delivering in communities and creating jobs and businesses, so we do anticipate that it will be extended, but it's, to this date that hasn't happened. The Portland Family of Funds United Fund Advisors experience in the Federal New Market Program is among the most extensive and successful in the country. We've built a national reputation as a company that executes efficiently, finances challenging deals, and provides outstanding asset management service. Our firm manages both real estate and energy investment funds, structure financing, source debt and equity, provide regulatory compliance management, and perform community impact and investor reporting services, not just for the CDEs that we manage, but for others across the country. All of PFF, UFA, fund management and advisory services are driven by its triple bottom line mission to create opportunities for profitable investments which enhance social and environmental yields. Our particular New Market Tax Credit financing experience to date has been to manage two affiliate CDEs for a total of $215 million. One of these is local to Oregon. The other is national. We advise on 11 other CDEs, bringing in another total of another $490 million. We've closed over 30 New Market Tax Credit investment deals during 2005-2008. And one of the things that we typically include with a lot of our projects are historic tax credits, so we managed to mix or pair historic tax credits with New Market Tax Credits as well. We finance projects that create both construction, temporary, and permanent jobs. They build local wealth as well as business and real property ownership. They deliver healthy buildings and clean energy and enable historic preservation and support education and culture. To date, our firm has helped finance real estate developments estimated to produce over 11,000 jobs and more than $3 billion in direct, indirect, and induced economic impacts. In addition, PFF-UFA requires recipients of its financing to sign a community benefits agreement, which memorializes the anticipated community and environmental outcomes of their respective projects. Investees are required to report on their projects towards meeting these goals on an annual basis. Our experience has been that just the act of committing and writing to the use of best efforts to achieve these targeted outcomes increases their creativity and their focus on the second and third bottom lines. In the New Market Tax Credit Program, an organization can elect to invest in a project directly to the business or to its real estate component. Our firm was elected to focus on real estate component for the following reasons. Our first partner, PDC, which is the $100 million program that we had with them, focuses primarily on real estate to deliver on their economic and community development agenda for the city of Portland. We found, for us, it's been easier to attract lenders and investors in a project where we have real estate as collateral. Across the country, the experience of using the two models, about 60%, 66% of the organizations across the country at this point have elected to use the real estate model. Both models work well. Real estate is simply one that we've elected to use for our purposes here in Oregon. Senate Bill 878 proposes to establish a state new market tax credit program similar to the federal program. And we would encourage such legislation and are working with Legislative Council and Advantage Capital to ensure language that gives this legislation the best opportunity to serve the citizens of Oregon. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Why don't we finish the panel and then we'll see about questions. Who wants to go next? Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, and thank you, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Brennan with Advantage Capital Partners, and I do appreciate your time and the opportunity to be here today. Advantage Capital Partners, separate from but similar to Portland Family of Funds, is one of those 218 participating organizations in this federal program. And just another couple of quick points on the federal program. This is proven to be one of the most powerful job creators at the federal level. The Community Development Financial Institution Department of Treasury now have this program that is bipartisan. They also know what to do with it. They've got Republicans and Democrats proposing to expand this program. They've done that every year that they've needed to. Both sides, we believe, were unanimous in the stimulus bill, adding this as part of the jobs portion. We were encouraged last year. This program was named as one of the top 50 innovations in government by Harvard University, and we think was a top three candidate for the top innovation, which they're going to try for 2008. So it represents one of these evolving programs at the federal level that really is demonstrating results and has a track record. One of the ways that everyone recognizes it is a bit lumpy is that the dollars are not allocated like CDBG money or HUD money per capita. So a state doesn't automatically get a certain amount to go into its projects, even though there may be many reasonable and deserving projects or companies. So you might have a state like North Carolina that seems to have a disproportionate number of banks that gets a lot of new markets tax credits. You might have Maryland, because of several active developers, gets a lot. You might have states perhaps like Oregon that are behind the average per capita. That's really the design of this program, is that we know there are billions of dollars of federal money ready to be invested. This magnet acts as an attractor for capital from those entities that have competed and been given awards to invest their money, their patient money, in the state of Oregon. And that's the mechanics of the bill, is that the only thing it does differently is to say that you can't take any of the tax credit benefit until year three. So the state has to have 2+ years of economic benefit accrue, and that money still needs to be in the company, and that company still needs to be employing people before any tax, future tax revenues can be foregone. If not, both future tax credits and any that have been taken, even if in year 6.5 the money is paid back or the company no longer has access, that entire stream of tax credits is recaptured, both by the federal government and by the state. I thought I'd speak just a moment to Missouri's experience. There are four other states that have implemented this model. And as the federal program, as Mr. Talton said, is really only 9 years old, implemented probably in 2003, so there's maybe 5 years of federal experience, there's really 2 or 3 years of state experience with these state-level tax credits. Missouri's program is the one that is most similar to what's proposed here in Oregon. Missouri has $185 million of money to be invested in businesses, small businesses that employ employ people. It is a 7-year credit, but the credit begins in year 3. And again, credits can be recaptured if they are not left into the portfolio companies. In the first year and a half, Missouri has seen, done by an outside audit, about 1,700 jobs created or retained, and approximately $29 million in new general fund revenue to the state of Missouri before the first tax credit is hit. And when it does hit, that'll be a $15 million annual tax credit. The economic impact analysis shows that it will be about a 2-to-1 return for the state of Missouri in a conservative estimate for the dollars that the state contributed versus new direct general revenue that will come in from those jobs created. And other states are seeing the same thing. The state of Illinois just signed into law their new markets development program, so it's a trend that is continuing. And as Craig pointed out, there is this first mover advantage, it would seem, for Oregon, because people in the Northwest states have not yet adopted this model. So thank you for your consideration. We think it's a program that is new enough for a first mover advantage. It has a track record, and importantly, it's based on a very successful federal program.
Thank you. Jack?
Thanks, Madam Chairwoman. If I could just amplify a couple points made by the panel here. Mr. Talton mentioned...
Give your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry, for the record. Jack Esselman, here on behalf of Portland Family of Funds and its affiliate, United Fund Advisors. Mr. Talton mentioned that under the federal New Market Tax Credits Program, an organization can provide investments directly in a business, which we understand is what Advantage Capital does, or in its real estate component. Senate Bill 878, as drafted, would just incorporate those investments directly into businesses. So we, together with Mr. Campbell and his client, are pursuing amendments at Legislative Council to ensure that the real estate component, which Oregon has enjoyed a fair amount of success with, is also incorporated into this bill. And so we would support Senate Bill 878 as amended with those amendments. And we think that we concur completely with Mr. Campbell and Advantage that adding this credit would give Oregon a unique competitive advantage compared to other states across the nation. And that's due in no small part to the success that Mr. Talton's organization, Portland Family of Funds and United Fund Advisors, has enjoyed. Projects like the Nines, the rehabilitation of the Meyer and Frank building downtown, were funded through new market tax credits. Also, the Armory building remodel in Portland are among a few landmark projects that were financed through the use of new market tax credits. These credits can have a profound effect and are a unique tool available to states and regions that are able to compete, and that's what we're seeking to pursue in this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Craig, you wanted to kind of conclude by talking about the nuts and bolts of the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, again, for the record, Craig Campbell. Now that we've talked about what the benefits of the bill are, probably would be a good thing for the committee to hear actually how it works. What the state offers up is a tax credit for what would be an equivalent investment of $200 million in private sector funds by giving a 39% matching tax credit. Those 39% would be spread out over the last 5 years of a 7-year period, starting with 7% in the first year and then going on to 8% for the following 4 years. Assuming that in the first year of the 7 years, all $200 million was invested in businesses in Oregon, the cost for the credit to the general fund would be $14 million in the first year and then $16 million for each year thereafter. The estimation of what Oregon will bring in by way of new jobs and income tax that will result from those jobs, we anticipate will look very much like what happened in Missouri, where they had a 2-to-1 return. So it's a very good investment for the state on that that side. Now, the nuts and bolts, there are some restrictions on who can actually borrow money from those who are lending. It has to be businesses that have tried to acquire funding through a bank but were turned down in whole or part. That doesn't mean that the bank can't participate in follow-on processes. In fact, banks are often a critical part of the kind of package of loan materials that are put together. This is kind of a mezzanine sort of operation where they will add in as what is needed to complete the deal as it is with the bank and with those who are taking advantage of the new markets tax credit. So as far as the Department of Revenue and where they come into the process, anyone who wants to apply for an allocation must have already gone through the federal allocatee process. They've got to have turned in this very large amount of documentation indicating not only do they have the ability to raise the funds, but they have a good track record of investing those funds throughout the United States and can demonstrate that they have good fiscal protection processes in place. So all of the difficult work is really done at the federal level. What the Department of Revenue will do is they will take those people who are applying and they will break up the $200 million worth of income or loan materials that would be eligible for the tax credit amongst those who want to apply the loan. So they will have that role. In addition, they will also be responsible for capturing information that results from those loans. And one of the things we'll be working on by way of amendments is tracking jobs created, the average salary that was brought in, health benefits, things like that. So you as a legislator, as we go through this process, are very comfortable with the return you're getting on the investment of the tax credit that you're putting forward. And the benefit is you get to do that before any of the tax credits go out. So that's the way the nuts and bolts of this particular package work. And if you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, this is just for blighted areas. The only one I'm actually familiar with is the directly is the Union Gospel Mission, where the Portland Family of Funds got a federal. So maybe you could just talk to me through about how that worked out in terms of the benchmarks that you have here.
We collect all of that information, all the reporting and so forth, and I'd be happy to provide that to you directly. They have met all of their employment goals. It was one of the first projects that we actually did. They had raised a substantial amount of money, and as was pointed out here, this is basically a gap filler program. So these are for investments and projects that typically have raised a substantial amount of debt or equity on their own, but still have a gap in order to kind of close the project, and that's when we come in. So that particular project was well along in its process before we kind of stepped in. It was a deal that was done very quick, very rapidly, and it's one of the deals that we're certainly very proud of in Portland.
And because it is a tax credit, you have to be an income tax state to take advantage of it. So Washington would not be in a position to compete, or do you have a process where non-income tax states can compete?
Certainly at the federal level, the federal income tax is applicable. I think you're correct. I think states like Texas, like Florida, like Washington, that do not have an income tax, have looked at premiums tax that the insurance companies pay, sometimes even an excise tax. But I would consider those states less likely because that income tax is just not a direct fit for them.
And then the way your bill is structured, the $200 million, the project would have to be at least $200 million. Tell me how it works in terms of the threshold.
Certainly. As the bill is currently drafted, and again, it's based on Missouri's experience, there's a maximum amount of investment into these businesses that's subsidized. More can come along, and it often does at no cost. But $200 million of investment into companies in the state of Oregon. So that's what we call investment authority.
Investment authority, so it would be 39%
of that
amount,
$200 million. Yes, Madam Chair. That would be the on aggregate tax credit program, the entire New Markets Development Program. In the bill now it says that no single company could get more than $10 million of investment out of the $200 million. That's what Missouri and others have used to make sure that there's program diversification. Often you'll find the average loan size is between $1 and $2 million, sometimes as low as $250,000, but certainly no larger than $10 million. So that is the loan amount that would go to the company. And then the burden that we have, one of them, is to show both the Department of Revenue and the Department of Treasury in Washington that we've passed on a portion of the benefit of the state credit to the entrepreneur as well as to the banks that are participating. Generally, we'll do that by either showing that some of the tax credit is used as a down payment or equity for the small business, or that we're giving them a below-market interest rate. We have to be able to demonstrate that on a case-by-case basis to Department of Treasury as they track this program. So maybe a bit more than you asked for, but the investment authority total is 200. Many states have found that about 5-to-1 leverage will come in, so we certainly hope that about $1 billion will be invested over the first several years of this program. tax credits are only granted on the $200 million original. And then our firms, and certainly many others, will come to the Department of Revenue and say, we have a business that would like to get a new markets loan. Do you have authority under the state program left to do it? If they say yes, we begin the process of making that loan. And it's a first-come, first-served tax credit by the Department of Revenue. So they're not put into a subjective position of choosing which one is better. That's done at the federal level. Once we're qualified, it's first-come, first-served. If Mr. Talton and I show up on the same day and are asking for more than is available, it's allocated on a pro rata basis.
So where do jobs fit in on the selection criteria at the federal level?
It is a key part. We have to be able to show, first of all, it's unfortunately about a 60-page application to the federal Department of Treasury. We laugh because we're all in that process right now. And we have to both from a track record perspective, count the jobs created that are at the companies we made investments in. We have to track health benefits and show them how these are good jobs for these communities. And then we have to tell them how we're going to create jobs in the future. So it's a third of the application, I would say. And that's where Treasury really digs in and comes. And they've pulled W-2s before for companies that we've invested in to say, did they create the jobs here that they report in their application? So it is I think, if that's your experience, it's been a big part of it.
Yeah, absolutely it is. It's a very competitive process, so you need to be able to show that you've generated a tremendous amount of community benefit with this particular investment. Most of that community benefit is measured by the number of jobs that have been created. So this information that you're asking me for, we have that readily available. In fact, it's on our website. If you go to Portland Family of Funds or United Fund Advisors, it will show you every project we've ever done. We'll show you how many jobs were generated, what the economic impact has been. But I'd be happy to make sure that you get a copy of that, Chair Brady.
Well, thank you very much. You know, it's a very valuable program at the federal level, so our question as legislators is how important would it be to have a state, to have the state playing in it, too?
Sure.
I mean, what you said that Missouri adopted this kind of tax credit, what kind of increase did they see in allocation of federal funds?
We have data for about the first 18 months of the program, and they have seen an additional $285 million of federal allocation to the state, and the state credit has only been on about $130 million of that. Because what they have found is that all of a sudden, there's a big spotlight on the state of Missouri. When Louisiana did it, there became a big spotlight on the state of Louisiana. So all of these 218 investment firms across the country, we get emails, letters, faxes, deals from companies that are looking to raise a new markets tax credit investment. And frankly, many firms, ours included, will look first at the ones from Missouri and the ones from Louisiana because we can invest anywhere nationally. I think that's what Oregon can expect, is that at an absolute minimum, you're going to see an increase of $200 million in the federal allocation. Other states' experiences, it has been more, especially since the amount of the state match can be no more than $10 million. Some of these deals might be larger. So people will contribute $20, $30 million of their federal allocation, but only take state match on the first 10 because that's the limit. So everything that we've seen in the first 24 months in Louisiana, 18 months in Missouri, is that they have rocketed from the bottom quartile in new markets investments, maybe to the top 10.
Okay, and finally, what can you just tell us again how the clawback provision works? If the company, what are the criteria, and how the state gets its money back if the company doesn't come through?
Certainly, each year. A participant in the federal program and in the state program is responsible for demonstrating where their investments have been made and that those investments are still in place. This is a big part of the tracking that the federal government does, Department of Treasury, on this. Under current federal statute, if at any point within a seven-year period after you make the investment that the money is no longer available to the company, all of the tax credits are recaptured from the taxpayers that ultimately use them. So if in year six a company says, Advantage Capital, we just don't need your money anymore, we'd like to give it back, We either have to make a replacement investment in that same community or in that same state, or our investors lose their credits for that seven-year period. So functionally, the IRS in Washington, D.C., would be instructed by the Department of Treasury to make a recapture of tax credits given or an increased tax onto the people that took that credit. Department of Revenue in Oregon would track that IRS action, and it says in the state legislation that they would take the same action. So again, it's not up to Department of Revenue to have to track all of these day by day, hour by hour. They can follow on what the Department of Treasury does to make sure that those funds remain invested.
Okay. Senator Hess.
Thank you. I just kind of want to follow up on your question, Madam Chair. I think it was really the heart of the question on so many of these tax credits, incentive issues, is at what point are we actually incenting behavior
sure.
versus that which would have been done anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned Louisiana has it, and Missouri has it, and then Oregon has it, and then New York passes it, and then California passes it, and pretty soon everybody's got it. And, you know, Wall Street Journal did a famous series a couple of years ago about the spiral to the bottom where,
mm-hmm.
you know, everybody's trying to attract jobs and companies, and pretty soon everybody's broke and nothing happens. And I think that's kind of, you know, not that I'm not supportive of that by that question, but I mean, really, how can you, I guess, guarantee that this is a benefit, that it will incent behavior?
And boy, you certainly asked the key question for economic development, the but-for question. How can you say? And I remember that article from the University of Chicago as well, that, you know, everybody offers incentives, pretty soon we're just cannibalizing each other. There are two things I think that come to mind. One is that I would not recommend this bill only as a way to compete with your neighboring states. I think that you look at this bill as a way to funnel capital, private capital, to companies that are literally dying on the vine. And that 39% federal credit, although helpful, does not often fill that whole gap for a company. So it is both a competitive advantage for Oregon, but I think it's also about knowing that those companies out there have to be turned down by a bank, and then they can access this type of program to fill the gap. So I think you can look at it as a competitive advantage. And, you know, as Chair Burdick mentioned, I don't think the state of Washington, Texas, Florida, and others that may get rid of their income tax are going to go down this path. There are states that don't, frankly, take their tax environment that terribly seriously, that probably aren't going to pursue something like this. I can tell you California will probably not do something like this. And there are states that already get a lot of new markets tax credit money. But I think the second piece is recognizing that there is this, as they call it, kind of the valley of death for these small businesses, that if they can't get this capital gap filled, they go out of business or they move.
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, another point, and I'll be corrected quickly if I'm wrong, but we're talking about a program that has a finite life. It has $200 million of investment set aside. When that $200 million has been invested, the program's over. It's not like a program where you can apply for a tax credit every year ad nauseum until the legislature decides to shut it down. It's capitalized, or it's capped at $200 million of investment in the state of Oregon. Only if the state determines it's really a benefit, you always in your decision-making process can extend or expand the program. But it does have a built-in limited life.
Chairman Burdick, Senator Haas, in further explanation of your question, the Portland experience has been that Portland Family of Funds was created to be a support mechanism to the Portland Development Commission itself, because the Portland Development Commission didn't have the resources necessary to complete the vision that the city had set for itself. So when you look at the dozen or so projects that we've been involved in Portland over the last 5 years, most, I'm not going to say all, because maybe there may have been one or two that would have been done, but most of those would not have been done except for the addition of the new market tax credit allocation.
Thank you.
Yes,
I appreciate that, I'm generally very supportive of these bills and supportive of this concept. I think, though, it's has probably responsibility for us to look at this in context of what it means. $16 million a year. I mean, I think that average day of school is about $16 to $20 million. Mm-hmm. That's an economic development issue right there in terms of recruiting businesses and people. And
I think it's our responsibility that if we were to do this, before we do this, we go into the tax expenditure book and repeal $16 million worth of other credits that may not be as high a priority as this, or so that there's still a net economic development incentive instead of just continually adding on, which has just been the practice for the last 5 decades. So I guess that's just more of a commentary, but again, don't take that to mean that I don't think this is a smart idea.
Madam Chair, Senator Hass, one of the other ways of looking at that, and we're going to provide you with some economic information that will develop this, but you're using $16 million of state funds, but you will have a return of $32 million in general fund taxes as a result, and you'll get it before you put that $16 million out. So the hope is we'll be able to demonstrate that through the formulas we've used to anticipate growth in other states as well. So hopefully you won't have to worry about that $16 million in schools. You'll have a little bit more to spend on them. So.
Keyword being hopefully.
Yes.
Okay. Questions from this side? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morris?
if I may, could you describe what a deal looks like?
Maybe we'll each do one.
Okay.
and if it's okay, actually, I'll talk about an Oregon company that we've talked to that I know is looking for capital. I don't believe they were able to join us today. A company called Plastifuel is located in a rural county, and they take disposed of plastics and have a proprietary process for refining those plastics into an oil-based product that they can then refine and sell. We met with this company as we saw them in California trying to raise capital. They need about $1.4 million to continue operations for about a 12-month period that will allow them to increase their capacity, get more of the finished product on the road, and be able to recoup some of that capital from the production process. What we would expect is in a deal like that, I believe that they've had banks or investors come and say, we can do about $900,000 or $1 million of that $1.4, $1.5 million. They've come to us and said, can you help with the gap? Our expectation, if we were to review that deal, do the due diligence, and choose that, one, it would qualify under the green technology and clean technology set aside in this legislation that I think is important. But two, we would be able to find a local or national bank that would be interested in partnering with us to lend that additional $450,000. So we would do underwriting with the original lenders or investors, and then be able to come in as that last piece, and then as part of that, either apply the tax credit to the interest rate, so maybe buy them down from 6% to 3.5% or 4%, or if they're unable to offer any collateral as part of that loan, to be able to offer the what we call tax credit equity as part of their collateral for that loan should they default. So for us, we think it's a valuable business to do. We like the business model. We like the business person. And there's capital that's ready to be invested, but those investors aren't comfortable doing the whole 1.5. So our experience has been these programs come into place when there is a gap like that, because frankly, with new markets, we might not want to do the entire 1.5. But the $450,000 or $500,000 necessary would be a portion that we could take.
What would be the typical rate of return to an investor in your fund, given the state tax credit and the federal tax credit?
That can vary, of course. We'll have two types of investors, what we call a leveraged lender, which will really be the person underwriting the transaction. That company will either blended rate between the tax credits, if they do that, and the portion paid would probably be at a market return. So that might be a 6.5%, 7%, 8% loan from that leveraged lender into this structure. And then you would have the tax credit investor, which would be on the line to purchase the stream of credits over the 7 years. And for them, they might take 20, 23, 25 cents out of every 39 cents that is generated through the project.
Well, it's a very high return for the investors.
It is, but it also comes with the underlying risk. I mean, neither of the leveraged lender or the tax credit buyer is risk-free in this transaction. Tax credit buyer can lose everything if this company goes out of business, moves, or pays back their loan. The leveraged lender still has an underwriting risk here, and even though they might be taking a 7 or 8% loan, they're still very much part of the business and part of their ability to pay back the loan.
Thank you. May I?
Please.
What would an equity investment deal look like? Could you have a sense of, could you share what something fairly typical
certainly
would look like?
Chair Burdick, Senator Morse, Advantage Capital participated in a company in Missouri called Quick Study Radiology, and it's a way to catalog and transfer radiological images that are taken. And we've had several rounds of investment in a company like that. That's a company that still has personnel risk, market risk, and technical risk. So we started, I think, at a 7% ownership of that company. And I will tell you, unfortunately, we're up to a 15% ownership in that company, and that's ballpark. As they've needed more capital, we've bought additional ownership in that company. We have deals where we are less than 1%, depending on the cap table. We have deals where, over time, as the company has struggled, we're close to 50% owners in companies. A lot of companies would prefer equity investment. This program has that flexibility. Most of them would prefer a debt investment.
In our model, again, we talk about the two models of investing direct with the business and the real estate component, and ours is focused on real estate for that very reason, is to reduce some of that risk. If you have the property, the real property, as collateral, that helps substantially. It's easier to attract both an investor as well as a lender in the process as well.
How do you show job creation with a real estate investment?
Well, let me give you an example. In terms of jobs, I'll give you our best example, which is probably the Nines Hotel, which was just done downtown. I believe that was $85 million or thereabouts, and it was a fund that we managed. Up front, we sat with the developer, and we said we want to make sure that this jobs component is in place. So we worked with them in, early on to make sure that all MBE, WBE requirements were there. The other thing that we did was to negotiate a contract with them, and then we hired the Bureau of Housing and Community Development at the City of Portland to come in and design a program to go to distressed communities and hire people to take those jobs in downtown Portland. I believe they had, the last numbers I saw were something like a 90% success ratio. In other words, 90% of the people who were hired that hotel came from lower income distressed communities in other parts of Portland.
Okay. That's Senator. First of all, Senator Morse, are you done with your?
Thank you,
Senator Haas.
Thanks. Was that would qualify for that federal program, the Nines?
Yes.
And that was a blighted area.
Yes.
Downtown Portland.
Yeah, it's the original programs that we did were in conjunction with PDC, and so all of their urban areas are considered by federal standards blighted areas. So there are two hurdles here. One is you have the blighted area component, which is typical of the urban renewal areas. The other is that there are specific census tracts that are set aside by the federal government that meet distressed criteria, and yes, that particular area does meet that criteria.
Well,
people are always surprised.
Well, it's right across from Pioneer Square. There's a George Mazer. If anything, it would seem like one of the more affluent areas of Oregon.
Chair Burdick, Senator Haas, to respond to that a little bit. Part of it is based on the income of households. Part of the measurement that goes into that is based on the income of households. And actually, the downtown housing, particularly in that corridor right there, is a lot of affordable, subsidized, low-income housing, which lends itself to that designation.
Yeah. And again, if you're focusing on your jobs, you've got to make that extra effort to make sure that you get that jobs component included,
right,
which is why we ended up going to areas outside of that particular census tract, but went to qualifying census tracts to make sure that we hired people to come in there and take those jobs.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, our next panel is Marion Haynes, John Marshall, and Jenna Kaluza.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Marion Haynes. I'm with the Oregon Business Association. As we've approached issues, especially as the session has gone on, we're really trying to view everything through a lens of repowering Oregon's economy and job creation. We really think that's where all of our focus needs to be at this point. We're also very well aware of the revenue situation here at the state, and so, quite frankly, when we first took a look at this potential new credit, we were pretty skeptical. We do support the bill that's before you now, Senate Bill 878, and there are really three reasons that you've heard, but I want to tell you the reasons that were tipping points for us in lending our support to this. One is the target of the credit, the low-income census tracts, and really from our perspective, it was the ability to drive some investment in the rural areas that was really critical to our support for this. Second was how this credit is applied, and two specific issues there. One, that someone would have to be turned down for a traditional loan given the current credit situation. We think that having this credit to provide an infusion to those particularly small businesses that may have trouble accessing credit right now is a big benefit of this program. And also the clawback provision we thought was very, very important to our support for this. And finally, it's the gap in the revenue impact that allowed us to support this at this time, that the credit doesn't go into place for 2 years, that you can see some of the investment coming in the door now before the state would see any money going out the door. And I believe that the Missouri experience showed that they actually granted out all of the credits in the first 10 months or so of the program. So to the issue of competitiveness and if other states adopt a similar statewide program, it seems to us that you'll really see that infusion up front right now when we need it most and before some of the other states maybe come on board with doing something like this. And for those reasons, we are supportive of this credit. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jenna Caluza with NFIB. I actually don't have a lot to add to Marianne's testimony. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 878. The big question that my members are asking with every bill this session is if it creates new jobs. And for my members, the Missouri experience was really compelling, and we do feel that this bill will create new jobs to Oregon. More importantly, I think that it was targeted to small businesses, and as the map indicates and from the newspapers, we know it's in areas that desperately need it. The last thing that was really important to NFIB members is that in this economy, our belief that it's going to attract private funds to the state that are going to invest in small business during this time where private funds might be tight is important to them. So for these reasons, and I'm happy to take questions, we are urging your support of the bill. I also submitted a letter in support from the Oregon Small Business Coalition, and hopefully you have that in front of you. Thank you.
We do. Thank you, and we will make that part of the record.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall, representing Associated Oregon Industries. And I guess I would say ditto to the folks here on the that have testified before me. It's one thing for the ability of Oregon to use state dollars to leverage federal dollars. We do that all the time. But it's another to use both state and federal dollars to create jobs, income, and economic activity, and I think that needs to be our focus. I think a question we all need to be asking ourselves, and while we're all sort of embroiled in this sort of short-term, how are we going to get through the next 2 years, a more fundamental question, I think, is what actions can we take now so that when the recovery comes, and I'm confident it will, I'm not sure quite when, but the recovery will come, and to what extent will Oregon be poised to take full advantage of it? I think a component of this particular credit program that's attractive is it gives you as policymakers an opportunity to weigh the cost of the credit against the investment benefits. because it doesn't go into effect until year three. You have a chance to review the extent to which it's actually produced the economic activity it's supposed to in terms of jobs and income, and then make judgments about whether the cost of the credit is overcome by the economic activity it's created. So I think that's a key advantage, and it makes it, in my view, quite a bit different than other kinds of tax credits you've looked at. And for those reasons, we encourage your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the panel? Senator Morris.
Well, thank you. I guess the question I would have is, you know, the state is in distress, not just in one area, but in almost all areas, except my district. We have the lowest unemployment rate in the state, but it's still much higher than it's been historically by a multiple of that, you know, about twice. But my question is, would this lead investments into areas that are, in fact, the greatest blight, economic blight of the state, where we have 15, 16, 18, 20% unemployment? Would it likely lead investments into those areas, or would they be, you know, mostly in the nines, downtown Portland?
Well, I think, Madam Chair, Representative or Senator Morse, the focus is on low-income and rural communities, and I think maybe this is a question best posed to those folks that have preceded us that know more about how this program has worked in Missouri, for example, than I do. But it would seem to me that should be the focus, because as you look at not only this map, but if you look at a map of Oregon by county and show the unemployment rates, the unemployment rates in the rural parts of the state are much higher. And it would be our hope that that's where the focus of these investments could be made, in those areas that need it the most.
And Senator Morse, I think we will bring, that's an excellent question, I think we will bring back the first folks to address that as well. Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions of this panel? Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Craig, why don't you two come on back? I think Mr. Talton has left, so
he's feeding the meter.
Okay, well, he may get a chance to weigh in this too. Senator Morse's question is really a good one. Is how effective would this be in getting the investment out to? We have counties in Oregon, rural counties, who are pushing 18% unemployment. Mm-hmm. And based on your experience, I mean, do these just go to urban areas that, like Senator Haas was pointing out, and, you know, this is in my district. The mm-hmm. Nines is in my district. And, you know, on the one hand, yes, there's a lot of low-income housing, but on the other hand, this is the heart of a very vibrant downtown where the unemployment is not as high as it is in Harney County. So can you give us some insight into that on the basis of your experience?
Sure. And Senator, thank you for the question, because I think it does speak to one of the strengths of the program. And I would refer, we don't always do it these days, but I'd refer to Congress on this one, that it really has been not just bipartisan support, but it's been geographically diverse support. So we've had Senators Harkin, and we've had other rural leaders that have led the charge for more New Markets Tax Credit money, while we've had Representative Rangel from Harlem in New York. So about 26 to 28% of the existing investments in the federal program have been in rural counties, lower population counties. So slightly more than population, as I understand it from the GAO study that speaks to this. So the best I think that we can answer the question is to look at what's happened federally, and then even in Missouri. I think Missouri's had about 30% of the investment in the program thus far outside of their major metropolitan areas, which would be St. Louis, Kansas City, and Springfield, Missouri. A brick plant in Mexico, Missouri, a sunflower seed company in Joplin, Missouri, that's coated with chocolate, and they're really very good. So there are case studies, which we're very happy to share with you, that this program has certainly had a focus on urban cores. That's been part of its, quote, magic. But it has a very strong track record for outside of urban cores.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, another thing that will be unique to Oregon. There has been a resurgence in efforts in rural Oregon to try and kind of, they realize they have to go it alone and try and pull themselves up by their bootstraps in certain areas of the state, and they've begun to organize around their economic development strategies. That kind of initiative will prove to be successful in this kind of a program, because as much as it's in the best interest of those who are providing the loans to seek out those people who need them, it's also in the best interest of those people in those depressed rural areas to try and find ways to reach out to take advantage of these sort of programs. To some extent, it's going to require a lot of communication through economic development entities throughout the state and focusing those on rural areas so that they know that they're available and can take advantage of them. As far as otherwise being a biased in favor of rural versus urban or the other way around, it really is depending upon those people who come forward to try and get those funds. So the program itself is relatively neutral the way it's drawn up now. It's really up to those who want to get the funds and get businesses going and where they come from that's going to be the key determining factor there.
So if and obviously the federal tax credit is way more valuable than any tax credit we're going to give at the state level. But if we did put some sideboards on maybe where or how this could be used, would that have influence on where the federal tax credits would go?
I think that it would. It certainly would have influence. I think any time that there are constraints or even directions put in the bill, that will affect which federal allocatees can participate. There might be some out there. Let's say this was a 100% green or clean technology program. There are maybe all of the federal allocatees that don't do that. Maybe they've had some, so they're comfortable doing a portion of their portfolio. The only thing that the Department of Treasury has told us and others about state matching efforts is don't mess with the census tracts. Because that's their banner of the program, is that the census tract from 2000 and upcoming in 2010, that needs to be the, quote, areas of eligibility. We'd be more than happy to talk about targeting, about perhaps extra incentives available to doing transactions that are valuable to the legislature and to this committee and to the economic development strategy of the state. I think that is what we have seen states be able to do. One thing that Treasury has requested is that you not change the geographically eligible business areas, and that is those low-income census tracts.
And you mentioned, you made a point earlier about how it's a first-come, first-serve type of tax credit. What is there any, I mean, is that a requirement of the federal? Is the federal one a first-come, first-serve?
The federal program is a very competitive allocation. So for about $3 billion a year that they can give out in investment authority, they'll generally get $30 billion in requests. Mm-hmm. Now, they have a staff of 75 people, and they have volunteer reviewers that go into the hundreds that take 8 months to review annually all the applications, check track record, and choose who gets the money. I think the current structure of the state bill is to say, let's leverage off that expertise, that once you're approved and you're in, that we know that you are legitimate. And the state credits will be first come, first serve.
Okay, what about if we had a requirement at the state that maybe bumped up the employment piece of it? Mm-hmm. In other words, you have to not only qualify for all the federal, examinations mm-hmm. that they do, but in addition to get the state credit, you have to be in, say, an unemployment area of over X percent, or you have to show, a higher level of job creation.
Sure.
How would that work?
We'd be happy to review that. I think that's an interesting thought. We haven't really seen states do that thus far. And as you know better than I, there's just that point of intersection where the targeting becomes so robust that you lose participants and that the program can't be actually utilized. But I think that's a very interesting idea. We'd be happy to talk with you about that.
And, Madam Chair, another comment on that point. The more restrictive you make the requirements on those who are funding, the more likely they will choose to make investments that may not be as good as other investments that are available. However, when you're talking about putting those parameters for making sure that there's a certain amount of investment that goes to rural Oregon, that's something that probably can be figured out.
Morris.
Yeah, thank you. And I can appreciate the need to not redo this map, but I do have some very serious questions about it, though, because looking at it, Lakeview would be excluded. It appears that Prineville, Madras, possibly Bend, or a very small portion of Bend might be included. In Linn County, looking at the canyon that goes up along North St. Anne, Mill City, Detroit, Lyons, none of those areas would be included. Mallala, Canby, Clackamas virtually is excluded. Columbia County, virtually excluded. They've got serious problems there. But it looks like that there is really an uneven playing field on this census map. That would, I'm sure, would be of great concern to some of these legislators that represent these areas.
Mm. And boy, it's certainly hard to talk about the 2000 census, but it is a portion, a blunt portion of this federal program, is that they are relying on census data, and that it may not feel like it. Oregon has a wonderful map compared to other states. And I know that may not mean too terribly much to you, but there are states out there for this federal program that have 20 of 1,000 census tracts that qualify. Oregon does have, in comparison, a very large number of census tracts that do qualify. But, you know, Senator, I'm sure you're 100% correct that it's outdated. It is, you know, hopefully in the next 12 to 18 months, when the next census is done, all that information will be reflected accurately. And any money that is remaining in the state program yet to be invested can then work off of the 2010 census map. But as participants in the program, we're bound by the best efforts in 2000.
And Madam Chair, Senator Morris, that once the new map comes out, that becomes the map that would operate underneath this bill. It operates off the federal lead on that. So when they reassess Oregon, they find out the economic disadvantage and the much broader footprint than we have now, that map will change.
Other questions? Thanks for coming back.
Thank you.
Okay. Is there anybody else in the audience who would like to talk about this bill? Okay. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 878 and open the public hearing on the other bill, which is 765. Senate Bill 765. Chris.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 765 is a much simpler bill than 878. It simply extends a sunset for the income or corporate excise tax credit for property taxes paid on machinery and equipment used in farm processing. As it stands now, the credit actually sunset on January 1st, 2008. This would, in a sense, reestablish the credit and move that sunset date to January 1, 2015.
Okay. We have signed up Gary Conkling and Harry Peterson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Gary Conkling, here today representing the Oregon Wine Growers, and joining me is Harry Peterson Needry of Chehalem Vineyards, who's the immediate past president of the Oregon Wine Growers, and we're in support of Senate Bill 765. And what I'm going to do with your leave, Madam Chair, is we've given you a sort of combined prepared testimony. I'm going to provide a little background about how this tax credit came about, and then I'm going to ask Harry, from a point of view of a winery operator, to explain a little bit of the why it's important and how it's used and how it factors into business decisions.
We were actually kind of hoping for samples.
That can be provided.
Of course, as a professional member of the lobby, I will close my mouth and not watch any of it happen.
Let the shakedown cease then.
That's right. profoundly dedicated to making Senate Bill 10 work. Anyway, the on-site agricultural processing tax credit came about as a result of negotiations that followed a gubernatorial veto of a bill that would have provided property tax, preferential property tax for personal property on wineries or other on-site processing related to farming. It turned out the reason why this came up is that Oregon dairy farmers and egg producers do have, under current law, favorable treatment for their personal property. We were attempting to try to have something similar, different, but something similar. Local government objected because at that point it was objecting to anything that eroded its tax base. And the compromise, which was developed with the oversight of the Department of Revenue, was a state income tax credit that would provide roughly the same economic benefit for wineries or other farm producers that met the requirements. It was enacted in 2001 without much to do. It sunsetted in 2007, and during that time, substantial additional investment occurred in on-farm wine grape processing. It was not extended by the last legislature, so it's expired, and what Senate Bill 765 would do is effectively reinstate the credit and extend it through 2015. As Harry will give you a little bit more background, this bill also occurred at a time of where there were a fair number of legal disputes over what should be personal property. Because we're farms, certain movable items, if they were on one side of the farm gate, were treated one way, but if they were on the other side of the farm gate, were treated another, and weren't always consistent treatment of some of the equipment. And from the winery's perspective, at least, the farm gate, it was notable, but not a significant part of really making decisions about its investments in machinery and equipment relating to processing wine grapes. Crushing machines are a good example. You know, what side of the fence does that really belong on? Anyway, and I should note the other big issue, which even continued past this period of time when this bill was passed, was the treatment of oak wine barrels. We have continued to work with the department and have now more favorable treatment, but it is still not equal to the treatment that wine barrels are taxed in adjoining producer states such as California and Washington. The credit for the on-site machinery equipment used to process crops is limited to those crops produced on the farm operation. My testimony explains sort of how it works. It is capped, as your staff analysis notes, at $30,000 per year, but that doesn't appear to be, based on the experience, what typically is what people seek for the credit or what they qualify for the credit. Again, it does relate to a person processing on-site crops that they're also growing. So with your leave, Madam Chair, I'm going to turn it over to Harry, though I meant to do this up front. I wanted to thank Senator Haas for agreeing to sponsor this bill so that's on the table. So appreciate that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Harry Peterson Nedry, Shehalem Winery and Vineyards in Newburgh, Oregon. I am a farmer, and I've farmed grapes for next year will be 30 years in Yamhill County. Grew up on a farm in another state, saw the wisdom of moving here. Was not growing grapes there, but grapes are an ultimately elegant agricultural product. It's one of the few agricultural products, even though we could probably hunt for others, one of the few agricultural products that can be made into a luxury product. And because of that and the excellent climate that we find in Oregon for Oregon wine grapes. We have an estimable reputation worldwide for wine and wine grapes. It is an agricultural product, and that's what this legislation underlines. The tax credit recognizes the value of on-site processing of crops. It definitely is beneficial not to truck them to other places. It's beneficial for the people who grow the grapes to have a vested interest in how well they're grown so that they then can make them into wine and have a vested interest on that side of the farm gate, as Gary described it. As maybe a little background on me and our operation, I think we're relatively typical. We're probably median as far as size. We also pretty much typify the average Oregon winery and vineyards. About 90% of everything that we process and make into wine is grown on our vineyards. We make about 20,000 cases of wine a year. We make every 2 or 3 years a profit. We have debt of about $5-6 million for the operation that we have as a winery. We purchase equipment I'll take last year as an example, about $400,000 worth of capital equipment that the tax assessor sees as personal property. We have been one of several wineries who have taken advantage in the past of this tax credit. We have taken it to, realized about $11,000 worth of income tax benefit over 5 years, so approximately $2,000 a year. Is it a huge amount? No, but it's very significant as far as incentivizing additional capital growth within an industry that has proven itself to be very positive for Oregon. The Oregon wine industry 3 or 4 years ago when we did the last economic assessment is worth about $1.4 billion to the economy annually. So it is significant. We do depend on Mother Nature a great deal. We have a captive amount of investment, as I mentioned. We, in our small winery, $5 or $6 million we owe to the bank. And we do pay off about $500,000 worth of interest every year to maintain that equipment. To have it then considered by the tax assessor as personal property rather than fruit processing equipment, which is indeed what it is what we're talking about in this legislation. The effect of the state income tax credit is to encourage investments in on-farm processing. Even with smaller wineries, I'm a small winery, but even smaller wineries than us need to have the incentive to purchase their own equipment to process in a timely fashion what are very fragile grapes. On-site processing is valuable in a lot of ways, not only to the quality of the product that's being made, but also to the carbon footprint or the environmental impact that the processing of fruit or any other crop might have. To process it on the same location that you are growing it seems to be a vital part of not sullying the environment to doing things in a responsible way. The Oregon Wine Growers Association, in summary, supports the reinstatement of this extension and would like to have the processing tax credit continued.
Thank you. Chris, what is the revenue impact of this particular credit? Do we have that?
The tax expenditure report has it at less than $50,000 a biennium.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have a late-breaking trio signed up here, Roger Beyer, Sean Cleave, and Jim Welch. Looks like you lost Sean.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Roger Beyer here representing Oregon Dairy Farmers. I came up here, and Sean Cleave from Oregon Farm Bureau wished me to offer his support for on behalf of Oregon Farm Bureau. Also, he had to go to another appointment. After the last testimony, I'm not exactly sure if Oregon dairy farmers would qualify for this tax credit, but I believe they do, especially the new industry that has cropped up in the Oregon dairy industry, which is the creation of artisan cheeses. I'm not sure if they do, because, like I said, the previous testimony indicated there is a different tax credit available for them. But just in case it is available to those artisan cheese crafters, I believe it would be good and a good thing to reinstate it so that it helped them in their processing of that valuable product that goes with the wine from which you just heard about. So, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, you can ask me any questions you wish. I probably won't be able to answer them, but I'll give it a good stab anyway. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Beyer. Last session, I believe you hornswoggled me into supporting some tax benefit for egg growers. Could you refresh my memory on that one?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for that question. Yes, last session, I do not remember the bill, but it was actually an amendment was put into another bill specifically for egg processors. I believe there is only one egg processor left in the state. It is Willamette Egg Farms up in the Molalla area, and it was a tax credit for processing equipment. Actually, it was a property tax exemption, I think, for processing equipment for egg producers.
Okay, so that wasn't this same kind of thing.
No, I believe that was property tax credit.
Okay. Any other questions, Mr. Welch?
Chair Burdick and committee members, Jim Welch representing the Oregon Cattlemen Association and Oregon State Grange, and we'd be very supportive of this extension, our reauthorization and extension. I know I don't know of any of the cattlemen at this point in time or our members that are using this particular bill, but let's think prospectively. We're working right now with the Oregon Department of Agriculture and to establish some processing for livestock within the state, and there's been a lot of activity around that. We know there's a lot of consumers out there who would like to have some really great livestock meats and examples of things grown in Oregon at the market. And this bill would, I think, help on-site processing. And that's kind of where this work group working with Department of Agriculture is going for livestock, especially certainly around the cattle industry. So we could see that after harvest and before sale of the item, that equipment then would very possibly comply and benefit from this type of credit. And so prospectively, it would be something that we could very, very much take advantage of, and so we'd be very supportive of that.
Okay. Thank you. Of course, the market may be such that you don't actually need a tax credit.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Senator Morris?
I just looked up the ORS, Roger. I'm not a tax person by any means, but it does, in terms of findings, talks about the need for greater vertical integration and on-farm processing of agricultural commodities, which is a very, very broad term. And then the other two terms used are farm crops and livestock. So I would interpret that to be very broad.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, that's the way I read it, too, when I came into the room. But from what the previous witness testified, that the dairy farmers already have a separate property tax exemption. So that may or may not be the case. I'm just not aware for sure. So you may know more than I do about it.
Which wouldn't be very much.
Senator Morris actually is a tax person. He didn't used to be, but he is now. Good. Yeah,
exactly what that is.
Yeah. Why don't you say that, Chris?
I think part of where they may or may not overlap is for some of these other food processing or agricultural or husbandry processing equipment, if there's a property tax exemption, then that disqualifies for this income tax credit. So they kind of fit together. So the income tax credit here only applies to equipment that is subject to the property tax. So that's kind of how they fit together.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you for pointing that out, Chris. Okay, any other questions? All right, thank you very much.
You.
Anybody else want to talk on this?
Madam Chair, I had a question, not for the witnesses, but for staff. So would this bill go back and pick up retroactively from the point when the previous tax credit sunset?
I believe so. That's the way I read it. Yes.
And then was there a proposal last session to do the same thing?
I don't recall one. I'd have to check on that.
Hmm. It's just why don't you check up on that? Because let's see, it looks to me like there's a gap. I see. To tax years beginning before 2015, so it would be.
Yeah, it looked that way from the way it was drafted. So I just wanted to be sure.
Okay. Yeah, maybe you could find that information for us, Chris.
Sure.
Okay. Nothing else on this bill. We'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 765. And, committee, we are coming up on our deadline for bills in the Chamber of Origin. And the Revenue Committee is not technically subject to the same deadlines, but I just wanted you to know that it is the intent of the chair to finish work on all bills that we currently have in our committee by the deadline of April 28th, because believe me, our plate will be plenty full after that. And so I've told President Courtney that I intend to comply with the letter of the law on as it pertains to our committee bills, although we all know that we will have different deadlines as time goes forward. So, enough. We are adjourned.